We sampled it from him, but it's not the same bass line.
You can get in serious trouble for copyright infringement.
You got an Oreo going.
Yes? Copyright is not doing crap!
Copyright? What's copyright?
It's the right of the owners to control.
Right now!
You know what time it is.
Welcome to
the copyright
experiment.
Yes, welcome to another episode of the Copyright Experiment. Tonight we got a bit of a special episode. Earlier today, myself, I sat down with Dr. Kathleen Cross, from a professor at SFU and also the chair of the Media Democracy Project, which is holding their annual Media Democracy Days conference starting tomorrow and Saturday. So it's something that I'm really interested in because for the show, especially because we on the Copyright Experiment are on a kind of greater scale trying to democratize radio in a sense by allowing the music that we play to be available for all of you guys out there. So, yeah, without further ado, I'm going to play the interview that I did with Kathleen earlier today. So sit back and enjoy. So welcome to the Copyright Experiment. This is Dr. Kathleen Cross with us. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Kathleen Cross. I'm a professor, assistant professor of communications at Simon Fraser University, and I do work on democratic communications, gender representation, open internet, that sort of research.
Cool. Well, you're a great person to talk to because our show especially is about the ways in which more people are getting into distributing music on themselves, and we're trying to kind of bring some knowledge and show people how the ways in which music is changing because of these things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what, would you say that's what the Media Democracy Project is kind of more about, kind of democratizing media for more people to participate in it?
Yeah, I think there's really three areas of the purpose of the Media Democracy Project. The first one is to understand what the existing structures are. So in music, that would be distribution structures and production structures in terms of getting your messages out. And it would be internet freedoms, net neutrality, that sort of thing, as well as in journalism, what kind of investigative journalism is available, who owns the productions, who owns the organizations. So that's all kind of that part of it, understanding that. But the other two parts are what we call Be the Media, which is creating alternative structures and alternative voices, creating alternative media, intervening in the existing media scape, you know, whether it's, as I said, journalism or internet or music or creative industries, and offering financial supports for some of that. And then the third area of focus for the Media Democracy Project is change the media. This is our tagline, know the media, be the media, change the media. Mm-hmm. And changing the media means intervening in actual policy changes. So copyright information would be interesting for your group. Issues of access, you know, internet and digital access, but also issues of concentration of ownership, independent producers, the ability to access audiences, you know, the kinds of policies that actually have an effect on the mediascape. And, you know, it's fundamentally based on the idea that you cannot have a functioning democracy if you don't have a media system that is representative, that is diverse, that is open, and has a relative accessibility and freedoms.
And I think that's kind of been known for a long time as well, because a lot of the Western democracies now, they started off having really strong protections for media and press. Do you think that's changed, or how do you think we're moving in this? Are we keeping those values in mind, or how has things changed now?
Absolutely not keeping those values in mind. We have gone through about 20 years of de-democratizing the media system. In the U.S. and in Canada, actually, both countries, 50 years ago, there were maybe 50 to 100 media organizations that distributed most of the media of all sorts in the country, and now there's four or five. So this concentration of ownership automatically creates a smaller number of voices and a more corporate-focused voice, so that independent producers or diversity of voices or interests simply are not getting onto the news or are not being produced or available. And although we have the internet, which makes it available, we don't have the distribution. We don't have the kinds of access to audiences that the mainstream media does. So you actually have a narrowing of the democratic system of the within the media, and you have a narrowing of the views and perspectives and that most people have access to.
Okay, so it sounds like that the internet has kind of been promised us a lot more than you're saying it's giving us right now.
Well, the internet is a tool, and you know it's not. And as a tool, it has fantastic opportunities, and it's been a great organizing tool for environmental groups. We know it's been a great tool for artists and musicians to be able to get their messages and their music out there. But a lot of how effective it really is in creating a democratic mediascape is who controls it for what purposes. So it becomes, you know, if it's controlled by three major telecoms in Canada and they're charging you ridiculous amounts to get access to it that is not necessary, and they won't put internet access and lay cable in remote areas because it's not profitable, then you don't have that kind of promise of democratic potential that it may have. If you have throttling of bandwidth, if you have the big telecoms wanting to create a fast lane and a slow lane, it's so that the companies, the big for-profit companies that want to pay for a faster lane get first access on the internet. This is what the whole net neutrality debate is about, where everyone else has to use a slow lane or their pages don't get loaded up, etc. You know, and you have that kind of control and containment of the internet and policy that doesn't protect that, the promise is being broken. So there's a huge potential there for democratic communication. And there is some indications to the extent that, we can learn about things that we already know about and we go look for. But not all of that communication is being, or all of that democratic potential is being realized. A lot of it's being contained.
So you'd say that the discovery aspect of discovering new information is kind of being hindered.
Yeah, I mean, the internet, like social media, is self-defining. You go and you Google something, or you look for something. You go and you friend somebody, or you look for sites that you already know about, or you follow Tumblr or Twitter. You're self-selecting, and that can create kind of information silos where you're only listening or paying attention to groups you already know about and you already agree with. Instead of a kind of broader access, which traditional media was pretty good at when it actually had diversity, where you might learn about something you didn't know about and that isn't in your group of friends or your, even your political perspective. It's like, oh, that's kind of interesting. So there's less of that happening. You're creating these kind of information silos. I think the other thing that's going on around some of the problems about that is the problems around when we go on the internet, how is our information being used? And that every time we go on Facebook or Twitter or, people are making money off of the algorithms of our data. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of like doing free labor for other people to make gazillions of dollars, that being a technical economic term, gazillions. And we don't even own that information anymore. So you find people whose photos are being used to sell other information because you don't own it anymore. You don't have control over your own information, breaches of privacy. So you have these real conflicts that are basically being decided on the basis of profit, not on the basis of democracy. And in many cases, those are in contradiction to each other. Those are in conflict, mm-hmm. you know, for-profit and democratic potential. And in almost every case, it's the for-profit that seems to win out rather than democratic potential.
Mm. Do you think it's a problem that a lot of the avenues of communication are being controlled by corporations? Is that inherently a problem? Or is there, I mean, if we go back to earlier methods of communication, such as telephones, there a lot of it was also laid by corporations. Do you think there's a difference with digital technology that it's more dangerous that corporations are controlling it?
Well, there is. Telephone is a perfect example. So telephones, yes, they were initially, actually, they were crown monopolies. Mm. So they had a public interest mandate. They had to lay telephone wires even where it wasn't profitable. They could only, you know, I mean, I lived in the Yukon for 15 years. Believe me, there would still not be telephones up mm-hmm. there if they didn't have to have telephones. You know, and it's the same with radio. Yes, they were corporations, and they, many of them became privatized mostly in the 60s, but also in the 70s, into corporations that were private. But they still had this public service mandate, and the public service mandate that was right into their contracts was that you had to make. If you're going to have the contract for BC or you're going to have the contract for Ontario, it had to have access to every part of Ontario, the really profitable and the not so profitable. So, in other words, telephone was seen as an absolute necessity for democratic communications, and everyone had to have access to it. So that's the first thing that was different about, you know, 30, 40 years ago. The other thing that was different was that they had no control over content. They couldn't. You know, they were creating the infrastructure. They were laying the cable and giving you the telephone wires and, you know, and you were paying for that to a certain extent. But they couldn't decide who could use the phone and who couldn't, who had better service and who didn't. You know, that was based on your location, not based on your political beliefs or, you know, whether you were dominant or, you know, in a community. And that's a sort of thing that corporations have a lot more control over now because of convergence of the kind of institutional infrastructure, you know, groups like the telecoms, buying up the content groups like television broadcasting and, you know, so now they do have control over content. They not only decide the infrastructure, they also have a major influence on what content is going on that infrastructure. And with net neutrality fears, and this did happen in BC when there was a TELUS strike, that if they don't like the content, they can shut it down. And they did do that with the union site on the TELUS.
Wow.
On the TELUS ISP because they didn't like what the union was saying when they were on strike against TELUS. So, you know, that's the result of convergence. That has only happened since, you know, 2010, you know. And so these are much different than the kind of public service infrastructure layers that telephone companies were in the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, does that mean that corporations shouldn't have control over it, or should our, for example, our government be enacting policies that restrict that kind of conglomeration?
Yeah, there's a lot of options and possibilities to fix some of this. One of it is you can, you know, break up the monopolies or the oligopolies, you know, that there shouldn't have this much of the bandwidth, for example. So four companies in Canada own 90% or 92% of the bandwidth. Open Media has the stats on that. But, you know, it's like it's that high. So break it up. Let the smaller companies in. Another thing is to have more opportunity like they do with radio and television. There's some requirement in the Broadcasting Act to have community-based nonprofit radio, Aboriginal radio, campus radio, like you guys. You know, that's in the Act. There's no ability to do that on the Internet at this point. They could put that in the Telecommunications Act so that you could have nonprofit profit ISPs, and you could have ones that are interested in access elsewhere and right. outside of the big telecoms. You could have, or you could have a system like the CBC in broadcasting, where even if it's not profitable, there is some money hived off the profits of the big telecoms to help pay for internet access to remote communities, mm-hmm. remote First Nations communities, you know, that where it's not profitable for them to go. And yet we know that internet is the new broadcaster.
Right.
You know, we need to have access to it to function in mm-hmm. most of our jobs these days. And yet there's whole swaths of our country that don't have mm-hmm. it. They have telephone, they have radio, they don't have internet because it's a different, it's the Telecommunications Act doesn't have it. So you can have that in written right into the Telecommunications Act. So those are like three examples right there, but there's a lot of policies you can do to change that.
Mm, okay. I think one thing I've noticed, and there's a lot of smaller companies that have started up to try and fill these gaps.
Mm-hmm.
There's like the smaller telecom companies in Canada. We've also seen smaller distribution labels online mm-hmm. and services like Spotify, streaming services. They're all kind of startups trying to, you know, fill in that space that people are asking for. But, you know, a lot of them are also running into problems because, you know, a lot of something like telecommunications can be require such a long-term investment that, mm-hmm. you know, startup companies can't really afford to hang in there for.
Yeah, that is absolutely part of the problem. And the other part of the problem is bandwidth and spectrum. I mean, how much spectrum do you get if you want to be a small telephone company startup? How much of bandwidth you can get? I mean, there's, you know, in terms of laying the infrastructure. So they struggle. It's a huge front-end cost. And like I said, with the broadcast sector, the taxation, governments paid for a lot of that front-end cost. And then for various public service reasons, you know, doled it out, some to private, some to public, some to nonprofit, some to community mm-hmm. groups. You know, and although the nonprofit and community groups has become smaller and smaller in broadcasting, it's still there. There still is some capacity for that. There's nothing like that in the internet. So to have some kind of capacity for the independent ISPs to have better access to distribution, because, you know, like with film and music, distribution's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just having the company, it's having the distribution and the access to mm-hmm. the infrastructure. And if the big companies have that all, you know, sewn up, it's really hard for the smaller companies to succeed. There are some startups and you know, all the power to them.
Yeah. Do you see, especially with music, there's been a real kind of grassroots movement for artists to distribute themselves and manage themselves, and they have the tools to do so now. Do you think those are viable options for the long term?
Well, they've been fantastic for the Canadian music industry. I mean, Canadian independent music has just exploded in the last 10, 15 years, which is fantastic. Part of the reason it's exploded is because of the technology. It's the ability to do these kinds of recordings and not in these big recording studios, the capacity to do distribution because of the internet and elsewhere. Part of it's also because of the requirement to have a certain percentage of Canadian music mm-hmm. on radio. Mm-hmm. If you have to play it, you know, then you have to go and find it. And of course, the big radio stations argued against that in the 1970s. But, you know, that created the music industry in Canada.
Right.
You know, and so and there are people who are still who are now saying we don't need it anymore. And I would beg to differ. We need it even more
mm-hmm.
Because this is what gives the ability for independent music producers to have their music be played. Even if it's not very much, even if it's not on the big radio stations, you know, it does get played. But having said that, there's two parts to your career as a musician. And I actually, my first degree was actually in music.
Okay.
So I was a practicing musician for a while. And the first part is getting the buzz. You know, it's getting your music out there. It's the opportunity to play and be heard. And so you're willing to do that for less money to create your career. But then you need to have enough to live on, and maybe even you know, buy a car and have a family, maybe even, you know, pay your rent and have a mortgage. And so you can't keep giving your music away for free. So that's the second part of your career when you need to have good remuneration for what it is that you're doing. And there's a couple ways of doing that. And one of them is give the music for free online, but, you know, charge for the live show. So some bands, especially the small, you know, smaller and medium career bands, go for the live shows. That's where they try and make their money, is on the live shows. I mean, touring is hell, but, you know, some people love it, and, you know, that's where you can make some money. And others will put some of their music on and then sell some and do the live show. So it puts a lot more pressure on the live shows mm-hmm. to make more money than before. And then the other way is to just have that firewall, is to make, you know, people pay for all of your music. And so there's this real kind of struggle depending on where you are in your career. And at what point do you have to make a decent amount of money out of the music you're putting out there, you know? And so I don't think we've come to a really good model yet. I mean, I think, you know, the best model that, you know, Arcade Fire and others have figured out is a lot of touring. Mm-hmm. But they're still, you know, in their 30s, right? you know, you don't want to be like a hockey player and be done by the time you're 32. You know, at some point you need to kind of think, you know, as a long-term career. So I'm not sure we've come to a better process yet. I think one of the biggest problems in Canada is the distribution network, which is really sewn up by the big recording studios still. They still control the distribution. They still control distribution on most of the mainstream radio stations. And that's where... And, you know, you can get interest for the work that you do on the internet, but people have to know about you before they go and find you right. on the internet. So there has to be, you have to use mainstream media for people, generally, for people to find you mm-hmm. on some level. And so, you know, I haven't quite seen the best model yet, but I was thrilled when indie music in Canada became so available. And, you know, I just love what a lot of them have done.
Cool. So it sounds like the big problem with the new models is that promotion and marketing and getting yourself out there, it's hard to do on yourself when you're, you know, giving away your music for free and not bringing in money to actually invest in that.
Well, absolutely, it's really hard to do for yourself. It's also a totally different part of the brain. I mean, if you're a musician, you're, you know, 10 to 1 that you are really bad at promoting yourself yeah. because that's not the artistic part of the brain. That's mm-hmm. the business part of the brain, you know, and you develop one or the other. There's very, very few artists of any sort who can do both. Mm-hmm. So you need some kind of a company or, you know, a manager or someone who's thinking like that and can do a little bit more of the promotion, which means you need some money to do it. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that money by giving your music away for free. But maybe giving your music away for free for some of it and then doing a whole bunch of live performances, you know, that where they pay at the door, that helps. You know, it's a struggle. I haven't quite figured out how people are going to do it, but they're trying.
Are you optimistic about it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I think that people make music and they make it 'cause they love it.
Right.
It's always been hard to make money. You know, there's you know, the one in a million who become famous and wealthy, but, you know, musicians and artists always kind of struggle, but they're always going to do it and they're going to figure out ways. And I think that technology has really helped in many ways that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly brought the cost down for a lot of people who were maybe interested in doing it but don't have the money to invest in equipment and stuff like that.
Oh, absolutely. Like when I was performing and writing music in the 80s, you know, we didn't have the money to do a recording. Mm. Now that wouldn't even have been a question. Of course we'd have a recording and be selling it out there, you know? So that was, you know, so that really has brought the cost down and that really helps. But how to monetize it, still a real struggle, I think. Mm. So the thing about this kind of new network society, you know, the internet, et cetera, is that it really does bring diverse communities together in the sense of, or rather, dispersed communities together, you know. So it's been a great organizing tool for social justice groups, which I'm interested in. So environmental groups, you know, people who are subcultures of any sort, you know. It's been a great way for people who are, you know, aren't geographically close to find their community and to organize. So I think that that's been a real positive. I think, you know, one of the things that we talk about and we're going to be talking about this weekend at Media Democracy Days is that one of the problems with that is issues of information control and privacy, because we don't have the same kind of privacy, and that can be problematic. How our information is being used can be problematic. So what we're gaining in terms of being able to access a lot more information and a lot more opportunity, we're losing in the ability to be private beings, and also to decide when our information is available and when it's not. And it doesn't seem important until you're just a little bit off the mainstream, and then it can really be used against you. And so that's, you know, that can be a little bit dangerous. And certainly people like the BC Civil Liberties Organization just put out a court case, or is suing the federal government to stop that kind of online spying that's going on.
The CSEC building.
The CSEC, exactly. And we've got someone from there on Saturday, you know, who's going to be talking a little bit about that. The issues around, we have Myron Grover, who's an he's from the BC Library Association. I call him the radical archivist, because he's talking about how the online information control is affecting what information we have access to, and the kind of muzzling of scientists, which we've heard about with the federal government. There's also muzzling of archivists, archival information and statistics going on that makes that information less available. And so that's really problematic, and is only possible because of algorithms. You know, you couldn't have that kind of wide-scale information control without that kind of technology. So there's, you know, as I said, there's opportunities and there's constraints, and we have to be sure it's not the internet good bad. It's who's controlling it and for what purposes.
Right.
And if the right people are controlling it, meaning those who believe in an open, accessible internet for the right purposes, in my view, which is democratic and diverse, and then we're okay. But public interest, you know, then we're okay. But if it's not being owned, controlled for those purposes, then we've got a problem. And that's sort of where we are right now, struggling with how... What model we're going to end up with this new dominant mode of communication?
Right.
There's a lot of people who mostly technology enthusiasts who kind of would argue that in all this change that's been going on, where we're kind of embracing new technologies and we're behaving differently, where our privacy concerns have somewhat shifted, some of them would say that instead of trying to, you know, latch on to our previous, you know, behaviors and the way we interact socially, that we should just embrace this new behavioral ways that we interact with technology, and just kind of accept the fact that things like privacy are never going to be the same way that we thought of it before. What do you think about that?
Well, I think they're right to a certain extent, that because of the way that this technology has developed and who's controlling it, you know, we'll never get back to those levels of privacy. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean that you give up on it altogether and say it's not issues of who knows what about me or you. It's what are they going to do with that information?
Right.
And if you can say I have nothing to hide, you know, learn what you want about it, sure, we can all say that, you know, as long as we have nothing to hide. But what we don't realize is when that information gets used for purposes that we didn't understand, and that can hurt us, like getting a job or getting a you know, the ability to fly, because back when I was 16, I smoked a joint, you know, or the ability to get health benefits because somebody found out that, in fact, you have a genetic predisposition to heart disease. Like, then it starts to get really weird, you know, and that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. So in the States, for example, because they have a for-profit healthcare system, they can get information, and they're trying to get information about people's health records. And you can hack in into some of those systems and get information about health records and use it in, you know, against people when it comes time to get their health benefits. I mean, that's not so good, you know. That's not having anything to hide, but that's kind of using information, your own information, against you. And that becomes really problematic. And it's hard to imagine what that could look like because it just doesn't seem possible.
Right.
But, you know, if you've worked in privacy areas or civil liberties areas, you've seen it happen. You've seen what's happened to people where this, you know, in this case, in their worst case scenarios, but, you know, you can see how it can be abused. The other thing about kind of technological enthusiasts is that the language, the rhetoric is great. You know, let's just move on. It's all innovation. And I love my internet, and I'm really supportive of innovation. But you have to look at the details, you know, and who's paying for that innovation, and how are they paying for it, and at what cost? Because if it matters to you, which, you know, one would hope it does, that your benefits are not directly hurting someone else, you know, and that connection has some sort of transparency, then you do have to worry about what innovation is being used for what purposes. So one of the examples that I use when I teach about this is the mining of coltan, you know, in the Congo. So all of our electronic materials, from an iPad to a cell phone, uses this metal, which is mostly found, 90% found in the Congo, coltan. And it's the thing that stops our cell phones from burning up in our hand, right? It controls the heat conducting. And so almost all of our electronics has it in it. And it has it is mined under the worst possible conditions you can imagine. You've got child labor that are pretty much enslaved by guerrilla militias who have taken control over mines and are, you know, with no protection. And sometimes these, you know, 10-year-old boys are spending 3 days down in the hole, you know, mining this coltan, no protections, no gloves, you know, getting poisoned, you know, like that is what is feeding our technology. Mm-hmm. And is that the cost we want to pay for the newest innovation? Mm-hmm. So you want to look globally. And, you know, it's not that I don't think we should have this innovation, but I think that we need to be aware of the what having that innovation and this new technology, how we're getting it. And is that the way that is that suitable in this world? And, you know, it's not to me. I mean, I can't find a conflict-free phone yet.
Right.
You know, and that's going to require policies, you know, and pressure on phone companies to kind of deal with that issue of coltan mining. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, everyone wants to kind of say, let's just move on and, you know, go forward in the future and it's all going to be better. But in fact, a whole bunch of it's getting worse, specifically because of the way we use our technology. So, you know, I want people to see that. I want them to see both sides of it.
Okay. We're going to wrap things up soon. Do you want to talk about Media Democracy Days?
I do. So the whole, this is the 13th year that we've had this conference. It gets between, close to 3,000 people that come and go. We have this great media fair at Vancouver Public Library in the foyer all day Saturday from noon to 5, which is about 30 groups that do alternative media and including things like open media with internet access and some arts groups and some social justice groups. So people who are creating their own media structures. We have a great film on Friday night at 6:30 at Cinematheque, which is called Terms and Conditions May Apply. And it's all about what happens every time to your information every time you click Facebook or Twitter or click that, you know, I agree to terms and conditions and all of what's behind that legalistic information. And although that documentary sounds really boring, it's actually been described as blistering. Like, it's really well done documentary. It's got interviews with, you know, Zuckerberg from Facebook and others, but talking about exactly how that information is being used. So that's Friday night. That's the only thing that costs money. It's $10 at Cinematheque, 6:30. And then on Saturday, we have some really interesting panels about diversity of voices, so some another number of Aboriginal panels, one about women work in media, which has one of the speakers at Women Work in Media, some of your listeners might be interested in, is a woman named Kimberly Vole, who started the Women in Games. She's a gamer and a game designer and started the Women in Games organization, which is very cool. We've got a panel on information control. We've got a panel on cyberbullying, sexism, and homophobia. So all of these panels are happening Saturday afternoon at the Vancouver Library downtown, all free. You just have to get there. A couple of them are in smaller rooms, and they usually fill up, so you want to get there early. And all the information is on our website, which is the Media Democracy Days 2013, all one word. Okay. .ca.
We'll post a link up on the blog too for that.
That would be great. Yeah, and so, and you know, a couple of the reasons is, you know, that I encourage students to come out to this is because a lot of this is the that we learn in university is theory about communications and sociology and diversity, you know, and human rights. And this is these are groups that are actually doing the work, and it's really inspiring. It's an incredibly inspiring and energetic kind of event. We only allow one academic per panel, so because we don't want it to be an academic conference. Right. So we have an academic or a scholar, an activist, and a practitioner on every panel about every topic. And so that creates this really interesting dialogue of theory to practice, you know. And so I've been involved for the last 5 years, and it's just been really a lot of fun.
Great. That sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
Hope to see you there.
Yeah, I will be there on Friday, actually.
Great.
Thanks for coming on our show today, Kathleen. Anything else you want to say?
No, that's great. Thank you very much, and I hope to see a lot of you there.
Great. Thanks. So that was Dr. Kathleen Cross from the Media Democracy Days. That's happening tomorrow, starting tomorrow in the afternoon, and Saturday as well, and you can check them out online. We'll be posting the URL for that on our blog, but I believe it's you can just Google Media Democracy Days and it'll show up there. We're going to take a short break and then we're going to come back and hear some new tunes. DJ Mochi is going to spin us up a new mix.
Hike, walk, and take transit to get around. But sometimes you just got to drive. At Moto the Car Co-op, you save big with us covering gas, insurance, maintenance, and monthly parking. Mention this ad when signing up for Moto, and we'll give you $35 in free driving. For other perks and more information, visit moto.coop.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
All right, and welcome back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. It's 11, almost 11:40. We're going to hear some music pretty soon, all free tunes as usual. Make sure you check out our blog if you hear any of the songs you like at copyrightexperiment.tumblr.com. And also, if you want to get more info about Media Democracy Days, we just heard that great interview with Dr. Kathleen Cross. If you want to hear that again or more info about Media Democracy Days or the Media Democracy Project that she also is the chair of, then you can go to copyrightexperiment.tumblr.com. How are we doing over there? You ready?
Here we go.
All right, let's get into the mix. This is a new track by Machine Drum called Box Off. Before that, we heard DJ Slink and DJ Fresh Direct with Murder. We'll be right back. Rusty remix of Pusha T's Trouble on My Mind. That's Tyler the Creator on there as well. Before that, what did we hear before that? That was Poppin' Bands by Metaphor, sampling that Juicy J track. We're going to be back after a couple ads. Stay tuned.
La-Di-Da Records presents the annual Fall Down Get Down, November 14th through the 17th, featuring the Dead Ghosts, Tough Age, Needles and Pins, King Dude, and so many more. Someday you'll remember me and picture my face. For more information and tickets, go to ladidarecords.com. Sponsored by CITR.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite. Indeed.
Dunkin's Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Welcome back to the Copyright Experiment. It's DJ Mochi spinning up some tunes for us tonight. If you like any of the songs you heard, check out our blog, copyrightexperiment.tumblr.com. I got download links for all the tracks, as usual, and podcast links as well. Listen to the rest of the mix. 10 more minutes.
Thank you.
Track is called By My Side by a girl out of the UK named Tiger Light. Before that, we heard Crimson from Calgary, the track called Echelon.
Gangsta boo, just keep it gangsta with me so I can stay true to you. You need me to count count your money, baby, I'ma add it up. And ask the motor what you got, because I'm coming up. Every gangsta need a gangsta fool, I thought you knew. You know you feel me, need me, want me, babe, don't be a fool.
Gangsta niggas love me. Me and the gangsta niggas got a fucking family. This is how I represent for my ghetto gangsta niggas. If you want a gangsta girl, holla at a lady. What? I love gangsta niggas love me. Me and the gangsta niggas got a fucking family. This is how I represent for my ghetto gangsta niggas. If you want a gangsta girl, holla at a lady. Yeah, ho. Yeah, ho. I'm about that. These gangsters want me on their team because I show that, and they all know that. And I ain't never been a weak girl, always been a gangster. That don't mean I be a killer, girl. I'm just not a waster. It don't matter what my dude need, I'ma give it to him. Keep it gangster at my own speed. I don't play by rules. I'm the mother of the family, but I ain't got no kids. That's the bit that just like gangster bitches is. Short skirt and heels, cooking dinner in the kitchen. Put the dope up on the scale. Our money is a digit. Never cross my gangster out, especially for another dick. And I don't like the police, so don't come and ask me shit.
This is St. John Hawk with Gangsta Boo, a track called Yaho. Before that, we heard a Drake remix by DJ Unique, that Jersey Club remix. DJ Unique out of New Jersey. That about almost wraps it up for the copyright experiment tonight. We got Pierre coming on with Oral Tentacles for the next 6 hours. If you liked any of the tracks we played, of course, check out our blog, copyrightexperiment.tumblr.com, and make sure you check out Media Democracy Days happening tomorrow and Saturday for pretty much all day. I'm going to be there, so come find me and say hi.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway.